Running batch workloads on Kubernetes isn't just about scale, it's about efficiency. Imagine handling up to 1.5 million core hours a month, but cutting your cloud bill by 70 to 90% using spot instances. In this episode of KubeFM, Niels Claes, lead engineer at DataMinded, explains how his team built Conveyor, a data product workbench on Kubernetes, and the techniques they use to optimize clusters, from switching scheduling strategies to bin packing to taming daemon set overhead. If you're scaling batch workloads and want to understand the real trade-offs between scheduling strategies, spot instances, and node design, you'll want to hear this. Special thanks to TestCube for sponsoring today's episode. Need to run tests in air-gapped environments? TestCube works completely offline with your private registries and restricted infrastructure. Whether you're in government, healthcare, or finance, you can orchestrate all your testing tools, performance, API, and browser tests without any external dependencies. Certificate-based auth, private NPM registries, enterprise OAuth, it's all supported. Your compliance requirements finally met. Learn more at testcube.io. Now, let's get into the episode with Niels. So, Niels, welcome to KubeFM. What three emerging Kubernetes tools are you keeping an eye on?
So the first one that comes to mind is mainly because we are using it heavily is Carpenter. It's not really emerging, but mainly the Carpenter support for Azure. That's one I'm really looking forward to. We did some very preliminary tests, but I'm really looking forward to testing this further now since 3 months. The 1.0 was released. I think it's a good thing to get started. Secondly, it's maybe a more general GPU support within Kubernetes. And there's a lot of things moving. And one thing in particular, we use Sysbox quite heavily for running IDEs on top of Kubernetes and the GPU support in Sysbox. That's also one that I'm looking forward to. And a third one, maybe something I also only got into touch recently. Is K6, so the load testing framework from Grafana Labs, in order to benchmark a bit further this scaling up and how much load we can handle within the components of our Kubernetes cluster, that testing that out and seeing how that will work. I'm curious for that.
Fantastic. So for people who don't know you though, can we just learn a little bit more about who you are, where you work, and what you do?
Yeah, sure. So my name is Niels Claes, and I work for DataMinded. DataMinded is a data consultancy organization based in Belgium. We primarily work in Belgium and in Germany. We're about 60 people, 60 experts. And within DataMinded, my role is I'm one of the lead engineers. I work on our product, Conveyor, which we will probably talk a bit more later. And next to that, I'm also in charge of a technical screening of anyone that comes into our organization, which is something I also really enjoy next to the technical work that I do.
Maybe you could talk about, just to take that a little bit further, how does the technical screening work in DataMinded? What are the things that you look for? I ask this because we also have a website called Kube Careers for people that are looking for jobs. It's always interesting to see what are the things that different organizations value when people are in the application process.
Yeah, that's a very interesting question. There's of course a lot I can say about it. I think what I'm mainly looking for is the mentality and mindset of people. People with an analytical mind to reason about problems, coming up with different solutions, and then making a trade-off based on, okay, this is the situation. These are the three pathways I could take, and I pick this one because of this, and this reason. And I look for that because, that makes sure that someone will become a good engineer or already is a good engineer, will become better because we can have a discussion on why you chose a certain topic or not. So the analytical mindset, and that's one of the focus points. And next to that, since we're a consultancy organization, I also heavily look at how you communicate. Are you able to translate your technical skills into convert it to business people and make sure that they understand what you're struggling with and what's the impact on their operations? Because if you're just talking and my Kubernetes cluster is in trouble to one of the managers or the department head, they will think, okay, but why would I care? Do I need to give extra time for that? Do I need to add extra people for that? So those are the two key skills that I look for in the interview.
Fantastic. I think with that too, it's something that we hear from a fair amount of engineers, that it's one thing to understand how Kubernetes works under the hood, but then how do you translate that? In an episode I was recording just yesterday, telling me like I'm five, you know, so this sort of notion of how can I make sure that these concepts are being translated to business value. For people that struggle with that, do you have any tips or resources that would be useful?
Not necessarily resources specifically, but if you want to know more about communication, one resource, the typical is Simon Sinek. I like the way he talks, but that's not technical. I think what you can practice though, and what I find very valuable, is to do whiteboard sessions with a couple of the people in your team and just discuss and be able to bring across why do you take a certain decision. Could be an architectural one, could be a purely technical language one. And just reason about this. This helps you think about, okay, how would I structurally explain this to other people, and also give some other perspectives which can be helpful.
Fantastic. So Niels, tell me more about your journey though. How did you get involved? How did you get into Cloud Native?
Yeah. Well, I started 12 years ago as a Java engineer within an organization. That was when, let's say, the DevOps mindset was not always there yet. And I mainly concerned myself with building applications. Java, typical packaging, basic stuff. But over time, I wanted to have more control end-to-end. I didn't want the dependencies on full operational team. So I learned more the CI/CD process, then Docker, then Terraform to manage the infrastructure on AWS. And then gradually I got into that cloud native stack because I liked it. It gave me a lot more options to control the end-to-end lifecycle of what I built, but also make sure that it runs and operates well.
All right. And what were you before cloud native?
Yeah. So I was a Java developer. I build applications with back then it was a Spring Boot stack. It still exists. I don't know how it evolved because it's been a long time since I've written a code of Java. But a pure backend developer, and that's what I would consider myself back then.
Good. And, you know, in terms of the Kubernetes ecosystem, we know that it moves very, very quickly. Mm-hmm. And it can be challenging for people to stay up to date. How do you do it? Is it through blogs, you know, videos, tutorials? What works best for you?
Yeah, that's, I think, a bit similar to most people. I read a lot of blogs. I follow a lot of publications on Medium or on Substack. People I find interesting, they have good content. So I keep up to date with them. I have a couple of newsletters, of course, that I follow. And apart from that, I think LinkedIn also works well for me. Also because you can tailor who you follow and then get the right content. And as a last, maybe a more wild tip is sometimes going to a conference to get a very different idea. What I have often in my feeds of blogs, it's reinforcing my idea of, okay, I read the same things over and over again, the things that I know very well already, which is good, but to sometimes get a curveball, something very different than my typical space. I like to go to conferences and get something new on my plate I need to check this out or I need to try this.
And Niels, if you could go back in time and give yourself a piece of career advice, what would it be?
I think what I now value most is, I think, keep things simple. I think when I started, I was really this engineer who also thought that he was smarter than quite some people. So also like to build very complex systems that in order to, and then have the idea that that's the only way to show that you're good in something. And now I truly believe that if you can write code as simple as possible, or your architecture looks simple, or sometimes even too simple, that's a way better showing of skills than if you build a very complex piece of code and a very complex that nobody understands.
Fair enough. And now, as part of our monthly content discovery, you know, we're always looking at different things that are out there. We came across your article, The Data Engineer's Guide to Optimizing Kubernetes. So we want to take a look at this, you know, in more detail now. But before we dive into today's topic, can you tell us about Conveyor and what kind of data platform that you've built on Kubernetes?
Yeah. Conveyor is what we call a data product workbench. What is the core goal of Conveyor is to make users more efficient in building and scheduling the day-to-day pipelines. So what we do is we take away a lot of the complexity, or let's say the non-functionals of building these pipelines. How do they get scheduled? Where do they run? How do you make them cost effective? How do you increase the performance? How do you secure these things? And let the client focus on I have these input data sets. I want to do this transformation with Spark or with dbt, and I want to get this output result. So they can focus on the functional layer, and we do a lot of the underlying plumbing, let's say.
And the scale you're operating at is quite impressive. Could you maybe share some numbers about your workload volumes and what makes batch processing on Kubernetes particularly challenging?
Yeah, we have a handful of customers that really run on very large scale, and we have a lot of customers who have a smaller scale. Let's say the large scale customers that there we see, if you would count it in core hours, between 500,000 and 1.5 million core hours. That's, if you would translate this in something that's more tangible, it would mean that it would be 200 or 300 standard nodes that are running continuously for a full month. But of course, since it is batch processing, none of these nodes are continuously running. We see a huge fluctuation throughout the day between the amount of nodes that are running in our cluster, depending on when workloads need to be scheduled.
Just out of curiosity, also as an extra question, I ran the data on Kubernetes community for 3 years and heard a lot about folks doing stream processing. Do you have any experience with technologies like Kafka, Red Panda, the Streamzy operator for Kubernetes, anything in that regard?
Yeah, so what we natively integrate well with is Spark structured streaming, since we also have Spark support already in our tool bench. So we have support for Spark streaming. We have, let's say, alpha or beta support on Kafka streams, but that's at the moment, and our customers, it's not in high demand, because we see a lot of difficulties. Kafka streams is a very different paradigm for a lot of our customers than if they are used to Spark. Then the switch to Spark streaming happens quite often, but the switch to Kafka streams, we don't see that much, so we also didn't invest that much time into that.
Now, you mentioned that Kubernetes nodes have significant overhead that reduces available resources. What exactly makes up this overhead, and how did you approach optimizing it?
Yeah, that's a good question. That's something that we always need to explain to every of our users again, is that, well, we manage Kubernetes clusters, and every node on Kubernetes has a certain available memory, a certain available CPUs, and then some disk. So if we take a typical standard node, 16 gigabytes of RAM for us, and then four vCPUs, well, a job that would run on this node hasn't got these full resources to its availability, because there is some overhead of Kubernetes. And this overhead is composed into two parts. So you have on one side a node overhead. You can see this as typical things that are reserved, resources that are reserved for the operating system. Also some reservation limits that are set before we want to evict certain processes. So eviction thresholds are they called in Kubernetes. And then a second big part of overhead on top of jobs is actually the daemon set overhead. And that's something that you as a Kubernetes administrator have full control over, which daemon sets you want to run in your cluster. But since they are running on, well, let's say all or almost all of your nodes, you want to have these resources as small as possible, because otherwise the jobs have less memory available and you need more nodes to launch it on. To make this a bit concrete, so I said a standard node for us is 16 gig RAM and four vCPUs. If we convert this to what is actually available for a job that we run on Kubernetes, then it's more about 14 gig RAM and there are still four CPUs available, but yeah, CPU limits are more throttled. It's not a hard limit. So there is indeed this ROS takes some resources of CPU that is available, but the application can go up to four CPUs before they get throttled.
Now, the default Kubernetes scheduler seems poorly suited for batch workloads. What specific problems did you encounter, and how did you solve them?
Maybe as a small remark, it's not necessarily that the standard Kubernetes scheduler is poor suited for batch processing. Kubernetes by itself has support for it, but it's, let's say, the cloud supported Kubernetes cluster, so by EKS and AKS, GKE, they by default have a very specific settings on how they want to launch applications. So what we see in is that all of these, all of those cloud providers, they only support the least allocated strategy when deciding on where do we want to launch new pods, on which nodes do we want to launch new pods. And the problem here is that if you have a highly fluctuating amount of pods and nodes running in your cluster, if you always distribute it to the least allocated, you always spread out your workloads as much as possible. And that means that you cannot scale down as quickly as we want. And then, of course, your efficiency goes down. And then also our customers need to pay more. So this is one of the core problems that we noticed over the past 3-4 years, and that we have tackled by the last 2 years by changing actually this exact strategy from least allocated to most allocated. So that's actually, instead of we want to spread it out as much as possible, we want to consolidate as much as possible all the pods on a node until it's full and then only go to the next one.
We noticed that your customers achieve 97% spot instance usage, which is quite remarkable given many organizations avoid spot entirely. What makes spot instances so compelling for batch workloads despite their unreliability?
Yeah, the main driver here is cost. We have, as already mentioned in a previous part, is our customers run a lot of jobs, and the cost reduction of a spot instance between 70-90% compared to an on-demand one. So we heavily see that for almost all workloads, they want to prefer spot over on-demand. There is only a small portion of workloads where they actually want to run on-demand because the reliability is crucial. And of course, within our platform, we also worked hard to reduce the impact of these spot interruptions or to reduce the reliability problem that exists.
And it seems like managing spot interruptions seems critical to your success. What specific techniques do you use to minimize both the likelihood and impact of spot terminations?
As you said, the first step is we want to minimize the likelihood of a spot interruption happening. And there are a couple of factors that influence whether a spot interruption is likely. And you have, if you work on AWS, they have an API that's called the Spot Placement API, where you can ask, given these resources that I want to launch, what is the likelihood that a spot interruption would happen? And then you can add some constraints. Mm-hmm. So that's, for example, one that we use if we want to decide in which availability zone do we want to run a certain job. We want to request these amount of resources. Which availability zone has the least likely chance of being spot interrupted? And we choose that availability zone at that time. So apart from that, we see that if your job is shorter, you have less likely to have a spot interrupt. Also, we see that if you also run on AWS again, the amount of instance type that you want to support is crucial, because sometimes a certain instance type is in high demand. It's good if you have an alternative. So for example, if you only have the general purpose M7 X large, if you only have the AMD version or only the Intel version, you might run into issues. But if you support, you say, well, you can pick any of these because they have the same resource requirements, then this can reduce heavily the likelihood of a spot interrupt. And then maybe lastly, that's something we noticed with a couple of our customers, is that, well, the region that you run in also has a huge impact. For example, most of our customers run in Europe, and in Europe, the data centers in Ireland, they are the first to get all new adoption, all new instances. So EU West 1 is the most mature one, also is often the most available capacity. If you, on the other hand, run in Paris, which are some of our customers are, there you see that the amount of instance types that support it are way less, and also that you way more often get a spot interrupt than compared to the Ireland region. So being able to be flexible on region could be beneficial, or if you want to select only one, think hard where you want to run the most of your workloads. So that's on the first aspect on, okay, reduce the likelihood of a spot interrupt. The second aspect that we work heavily on is to minimize the impact of when a spot interrupt happens, don't fail the full job. And in certain situations, that's fairly doable. For example, we run a lot of Spark workloads. If you run Spark workloads, we say, okay, you have one driver, and then you have between one and maybe 50 executors that are running. A spot interrupt of an executor is not a huge problem for Spark. Spark can deal with that. It will launch a new executor, and you might need to only redo a part of your operation depending on how you configured this. So there we say we have the option to run the driver on demand and the executors on spot, such that anyway, we are sure that this Spark job will succeed. And if we will need to recreate a couple of executors, that's not a problem. Since the Spark 3.2, you also have the Spark decommissioning support, which helps you even more. That it says, okay, if there is a spot interrupt, we're going to transfer some of our shuffle data that we have, temporary data, to another node that will keep on running in order for you to not have to redo part of the calculation. So that's a big benefit. And those are things that you can tweak in order to reduce the impact of a spot interrupt.
Now, batch workloads typically have dramatic usage patterns with peaks and valleys. How do you handle scaling when there's a 10x difference between minimum and peak utilization?
Yeah, so that's indeed a problem that we have been tackling for a while. It's, if we look at a typical customer, we have maybe a baseline of 50 nodes that they use during daytime because there's not that much running, but at night that goes up to 400 or 500 nodes for the same customer. So what you want to do there is you want to, of course, quickly scale up, but also be able to quickly scale down when certain resources are not needed. And then, of course, the components, the open source components to use here are Carpenter and the Cluster Autoscaler, where at the moment in our product, Carpenter is the default on AWS, and on Azure, we're still on the Cluster Autoscaler, even though that I would like to test out a Carpenter on Azure to see if we can migrate that as well, because the Cluster Autoscaler is way slower in scaling up and also in scaling down than Carpenter is. And Carpenter has a very nice feature that you are way more flexible in deciding the resources that you want for your node, which instance types are supported. You can give a very broad configuration on which nodes do I want to create, while if you use the Cluster Autoscaler and node pools, it's way more tedious to define all the different options that are available.
Carpenter definitely seems to be a game changer for AWS users. What specific advantages does it offer over the traditional Cluster Autoscaler?
Yeah. So I already mentioned it's way faster in scaling up. And one of the reasons why this is that instead of the Cluster Autoscaler being dependent on autoscaling groups and having the delay then, okay, to create these nodes, it uses a different API to immediately launch the EC2 instances. So it's way quicker in scaling up. I also mentioned already briefly the flexible configuration that it supports with the price capacity optimization setting that is by default within Carpenter, which is something that we used to do ourselves before. And that actually, that's a setting for people who don't know that. If you then ask AWS, I want a given amount of resources, that AWS will look, okay, what are all the instance types that are available that I can use for this? What's the amount of resources that I need? And from all the options, it will look at, okay, the instance that has the least likelihood of a spot interruption and a best price. So the combination of both, which is typically what you want when you run batch workloads. So that's a very handy feature that Carpenter has that doesn't exist in the Cluster Autoscaler.
Cross-availability zone data transfer can be surprisingly expensive. How did you discover this issue and what was your solution?
Yeah, that's a funny story. This is indeed one of these gotchas that you only notice when you are running in production and a customer comes with, team, we have a problem. We see that our data transfer cost instead of the regular 1,000 euros, it spiked up to 15,000 euros. What happened here? And basically, this boiled down to, in our case, that since we are running Spark and you have a Spark driver and one up to 50 or 100 executors, if you let it go freely and launch all these executors in different availability zones, since Spark does a lot of shuffling between his steps, it might be that you're shuffling a lot of data across ACs where you need to pay for on AWS. On Azure, that's not the case. But on AWS, you need to pay for that. So that was an aspect we didn't consider initially. Mm. The solution here is, you could say, fairly simple. So we still run in 3 different availability zones, but we decide when we launch a job, which availability zone this job will launch in. So we pin the availability zone, and then both the driver and all the executors that are running it, they run in the same availability zone. So this is something that our Kubernetes operator does before it launches the actual Spark application.
You mentioned that AKS and EKS have different characteristics and limitations. What are the key platform-specific considerations that teams should know about?
That's for us always a bit of a tricky problem, because we want to support both platforms, but they evolve at different speeds and they don't have the same freedom. They don't give the same freedom to, let's say, sysadmins like us to manage those clusters. For example, one of the things we run the most into is that on Azure, there is a lot of development. So AKS gets a lot of development, but they add a lot of features as preview features. And then it takes a long time before they become generally available, or they're not available in the Terraform provider. So there is a lot of things moving, but the vision is not always clear. There are often multiple options. So dealing with these preview features, whether we want to adopt them already or not, it is something that we often struggle with. Additionally, the fact that you cannot customize the image that you use for your AKS nodes on Azure is also something that we struggle a lot with, because we want to bake in some tooling, some images that we always need. We would like to bake that in within the image, that it's immediately available instead of that it needs to be pulled when the node starts. It's all about the startup time again. And on AWS, you can just create a custom AMI. We can package that all together. We built that once, and then we can immediately use it. But on Azure, this is not supported. So that is one of those differences. And then it's apart from that, you build an ecosystem around your cluster. You use open source components, and of course, not all open source components deal as well with both AWS and Azure. I already mentioned before Carpenter. Now it's available on Azure, but before it was not. How do you deal with that? You need to support basically 2 autoscalers, which brings again expertise you need to split in 2. So that's a bit of a trouble. On the other hand, what advantage you, for example, do have in Azure is that you don't need to pay for cross AZ transfer, which you need to do on AWS. So there are also some benefits. It's not that there is one better than the other. But in general, if you are experienced and you know which knobs to turn or you can turn on Kubernetes, I think most people would prefer, I will speak for myself, I prefer EKS over AKS, because on AKS it's way more shielded and you can have way less freedom to configure resource reservations, certain kubelet resources that you want to configure or tweak, because you know what you're doing. They prohibit that way stricter, and on EKS you have this freedom to change that and to test that out. So there I like EKS's approach better than AKS.
And self-managing Kubernetes components seems to be a recurring theme here. When should teams consider self-managing versus using cloud provider add-ons?
I think if you start, you should always start with the cloud provider add-ons, because they are, by default, it gets you up and running quickly. So you have something to test against. And then the only reason why I would switch to self-managed is if there are problems or you have some hiccups with these cloud-managed add-ons. And then the hiccups that we often see is that since they are anyway open source components, you have a lot of configuration options to tweak them. But the interface that is exposed by EKS or AKS on these add-ons is way more limited. So you don't have all the freedom to configure this. So if you hit an issue where you say, I want to configure this in a different way, and it's not supported by the cloud provider, that's often the moment where we decide to take it back and manage it ourselves, so that we have the full freedom to configure how we want it. An example here for us is on Azure, if you run the cluster autoscaler, you could not define any startup taints. And startup taints is basically something that we use heavily, since we run using Cilium, and Cilium needs to be installed on the node, and before it's installed, you cannot launch anything. So that's where they use this startup taint. The problem is the autoscaler, because the autoscaler cannot deal with it if it's not specified that this startup taint can exist, and basically has issues sometimes with scaling up from zero or scaling mainly scaling up new nodes. So since we needed this setting, well, we decided, okay, then we need to manage it ourselves. So that's one of these situations where you do it yourself. There are other ways. There are other examples, like, for example, the typical OMS agent, the monitoring agent for Kubernetes for logging and metrics from your Kubernetes cluster to your log analytics workspace on Azure. That has a default component, but we found the resources that it requires way too heavy, and we were not able to tweak this ourselves. So that's, again, something that we then manage ourselves. We pick it from what is open source available, and then tweak it to our liking, and then just deploy it on Kubernetes. So it's first, you take the add-on, what is provided by the cloud provider. Then you see, are we running into issues? And if you are, then you can decide, okay, maybe managing it ourselves will be easier. The downside, of course, is that it's often the operational burden becomes higher. So it's always a bit of a trade-off. So you need to have a good case and not always blindly say, I'm going to manage everything myself, because it also explodes the operational overhead that you will need to do over time.
Node pool design seems crucial for efficiency. How do you determine the right mix of node sizes and types?
Yeah, that's a very good question, and also something that I get asked a lot. The short and not helpful answer here is it depends. It depends really heavily on your workload. But to give a bit more guidance, we see that most people using Kubernetes cluster heavily, and also in our case, you end up with multiple types of node pools. And that's also why I say we have a default node pool, the 16 gigabytes of RAM, 4 vCPUs. That's the default where we launch jobs that have no specific, no large requirements of resources. So that's, let's say, the heavy workhorse. That's always the one where we have the most nodes from. But of course, our customers can decide the amount of resources that they want for every job. And how we do this is we use this T-shirt sizing. So we have micro, and then mini, and then medium, large, X large, 2X large, 4X large. And so if you go above an X large, for us, that's more than our standard node is available, as available based on resources. We configure different types of node pools for these large workloads that they get a dedicated node where they can run on. So the reason why you want to configure this is that, well, if you go too small a node, so let's say we go lower than 16 gigabytes of memory, 4 vCPUs, the problem is that your Kubernetes overhead on that node becomes too high for the workload that you can run on. Because again, remember that we have this node overhead, the daemon sets that need to run, what is reserved for the OS that needs to be cut off. So for us, the minimum is this 16 gigabytes and 4 vCPUs. But on the other hand, if you say our default is just a very large node, let's say 256 gigabytes of RAM, 100 CPUs, well, then you can say, well, you can run a lot of jobs on there, which is true. But in a batch workload, you cannot easily kill a certain job. So once there is one job running on that node, that full node needs to be running, and you have a lot of overhead that might be wasted. So that's why you go for this mixed approach. You say a small standard, and then we can escalate. If people really need a big node, they can get a dedicated big node for their request.
Daemon sets can significantly impact node efficiency. What strategies do you use to minimize their overhead while at the same time maintaining necessary functionality?
Yeah, I think here it's crucial for the administrator of the Kubernetes cluster to think which functionality do we really want to support by default for all the nodes, or actually all the specific type of node pools. Of course, you can have different type of node pool for different type of workloads. And you could, of course, add certain things and toleration that say, okay, these daemon sets only need to run on one or the other. But it's a crucial thinking to decide which daemon sets do we actually need, because they take resources away from the job that can be running on there. So what we do there is to really think, okay, these are the functionality that is required and that we cannot go without. And we need that on a node to be available. And the typical things like logs, metrics, you want to have node termination handler for our case as well. And then you have some other default things that are required. So that's one. You decide on which components do you want to run on a node. Second aspect is then looking critically maybe at the resources that every of these components needs. As an illustration here, so we started running Kubernetes clusters 5 years ago in our product, and we used Fluentd as a log aggregator and moving the logs from all the pods in a Kubernetes cluster to CloudWatch or to Log Analytics Workspace, because it's easy to configure and it's a default. The problem was, since it's written in Ruby, it's quite inefficient resources-wise. It requires quite some memory. And that's why we switched at some point to FluentBit, which is way more efficient. It's functionality-wise, it's a bit more limited, but it's way more efficient and requires a lot less resources, which is why our customers then have more resources available for their job. So for the same price, they get actually more value. That's how we tweak it. So I think as a sysadmin, look at which daemon sets do you have? Do you really need them for all these use cases? And secondly, critically also look at, okay, what are the resources that all these daemon sets require and tweak them where possible.
For teams just starting with batch workloads on Kubernetes, what would be your recommended optimization priority order?
Well, yeah, I come from a development background, so I really like the idea that also Uncle Bob always uses, like, first make it work, then make it right, and then make it fast. So I think this is the same in if you want to optimize the efficiency or you want to optimize your Kubernetes cluster, first make sure that you have something running. If you have something running, measure what the performance is and be able to detect where certain bottlenecks could be. And based on that, start optimizing. So if you then start optimizing, it will probably depend a bit on in which organization you are, but two key aspects that you can look for is, one, you first try to optimize for cost, and then the major cost improvement would be looking towards spot instances instead of running regular instances. And then the second optimization where you could look for is indeed this scheduler changes that I discussed a while ago, and seeing that, okay, instead of spreading over my workloads, I want to bin pack them as closely together as possible. So those are two very tangible ways of doing optimization on your cluster. But of course, this is not a finished product, and a Kubernetes cluster, or this is an evolving, well, this is a continuous process where we also always look at, okay, where are there still things we could either save money or we could improve performance, and testing things out and seeing, okay, which things work well or not.
Looking at all these optimizations, what were the most impactful changes, and what lessons would you share with others that are embarking on this journey?
Yeah, I already mentioned in the previous question, but I think the using of spot instances is a huge game changer. We see that if customers adopt our tool, they over time they begin using spot a lot more. If they come from another tool, they are amazed by the amount of savings without the reduction of reliability, or almost no reduction of reliability that they have on their nodes. So they are super happy with that. The bin packing, I really find super cool, because it's something that the user doesn't see at all, but something you can implement as a platform team, and immediately it gives the customer a 10 to 15% saving without them needing to change anything, having any impact. So if your cloud bill is 20 to 50K, and you say you can reduce this by, if your EKS cluster bill is the same, you can reduce it by 10% just by switching this on, a customer is super happy with it. Then again, looking at optimizations, I think what I'm always fearful for, or what I often did wrong in the past, is doing a premature optimization, thinking that, well, we need to do this because it will perform better. And then in the end, it turns out it was actually not needed. It was even contraproductive. So be careful in optimizing too early. And one way to make sure that you don't optimize too early is to measure first. You measure what is the performance, or you measure what is the delay that you have, and then look at, okay, what are all the components involved and where am I losing the most time? What is my bottleneck? And then try to optimize for that bottleneck only. If you all know that if you have a request that takes 10 seconds and you try to optimize for this 5 milliseconds part, there will not be the biggest difference. So always try to look what is the major time saving, where do you lose the most time, and try to optimize that. That will have the biggest impact in the end.
Niels, what's next for you?
What's next? That's a good question. I love what I do. I love looking at new technologies, incorporating new tools. So that's what I want to do further. Maybe as one concrete thing, what I'm really looking forward to, in a couple of months, I will be speaking at a European Big Data Conference. It's the first talk that I will do to a big audience. So that's something I really look forward to, also the discussions that I would have there. That's one concrete aspect. Yeah.
And for folks that might be there, what day, what place is that going to be?
It's going to be the Big Data Europe in Vilnius. It's in the 18th or 21st of November. So that's, anyone who is interested, my talk will not be specifically on Kubernetes. It will more be on using DirkDB instead of Databricks for batch data pipelines. So it's more the data aspect and less on the Kubernetes aspect.
Regardless, it's interesting, and best of luck to you with your talk. And if people want to get in touch with you, what's the best way to do that?
Best way to get in touch with me is through LinkedIn. In LinkedIn, I'm very active. I also write a lot on Medium and on Substack, so there you can also reach out to me. But those are the main platforms to get in touch with me.
Fantastic. Niels, it was great talking to you today. Look forward to hearing about how things went in the conference in November. Sure, we'll see you on stage in many parts of the world. Keep up the great work. Help our paths cross soon. Take care.
Super. Thank you. Thank you for having me. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.